Good morning. Good to see you all looking so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Welcome to Daylight Savings Time. Matthew chapter 6, 19 through 34 is our text. I encourage you to turn there if you have not done so already. In the country that we live in, there are many things that our government does not know about, does not choose to know about, and I'm thankful for that. For example, your money is your money. Now, the government does want to know how much money you are making so that they can take some of that and tax you off of that money. But if you are minding your own business, unless you're doing something drastically illegal, your money is your money. It is not under the authority of anybody else. You choose to spend it however you want to spend it. You don't answer to anybody else for that. But it's interesting that in the kingdom of Jesus, things operate differently. He has every right to shape and affect every aspect of our lives, including how we think about human money, about what money can buy. And as we've been looking in the Gospel of Matthew, and as we're going to continue to see throughout this Gospel, Jesus is going to continue to make the case in a special way in Matthew that he is king and has dominion over everything and everyone. The theme phrase for this year of study is up on the screen, "You are the Christ," which is what Peter will say about him in chapter 16. And when he says you're the Christ, you're the Messiah, he's saying you're the king. And the king gets to rule. He gets to decide what we value. He gets to decide what we work for and how we use what we have. And so this is always a very challenging text for me to think through whenever I read it and study it. It probably will be for you too, especially since we live in a very, very wealthy culture compared to so many around the world and compared to so many in history. We've got some serious questions to ask and to answer for ourselves about where our own treasure is. Are we going to pursue Jesus' kingdom and his righteousness, which is what he invites us to do in this text, or are we going to pursue anxious accumulation? Let's think about the first part of this and the three illustrations that Jesus has for us. So you see two different treasures being laid out in this text. Are we going to have a love for accumulating possessions that decay, or are we going to pursue love for fellow image bearers? What does Jesus mean by this idea of storing up treasure on earth or in heaven? Well, in verse 21, notice how he explains what he means. Because whatever you put your heart into, that's where your treasure is. I don't think he's merely discussing the things that we value, but the things that we value above all other things. And this fits with the way that we use the word treasure. Anybody ever seen Muppet's Treasure Island? Anybody read the book Treasure Island, Robert Louis Stevenson? Or any pirate story that has the word treasure in it, the whole story and all of the characters are revolving around a chest of gold or silver or whatever it is in that chest. That's the idea here. What is your prized possession that you sacrifice so many things for? Jesus is making the case here that physical possessions are not worth treating that way because they don't last. So if you stored up food or clothing, the bugs are going to eat it. They're going to find a way to get to it. If you stored coins, eventually they're going to corrode. Eventually they're going to become worthless. Eventually maybe your country is going to fall by the wayside, another country is going to take its place, and when you use your coins in the market people are going to say, sorry, we don't take those anymore. Or your coins are going to get stolen by crafty people who are very adept at gleaning from other people's treasures. That Rich and Diane are having to deal with people hacking into their account. Our wealth is not any safer today, even with all of the technology that we have at our disposal, than it was back in the first century when Jesus first preached this sermon. Having wealth is still an uncertain business, and it's temporary anyway, because that's what 1 Timothy teaches in chapter 6, verse 7. We brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. So instead, he says, make God's things, God's desires, what God cares about, your treasure. And what does God care about? Well, what has he been laying out so far in the Sermon on the Mount? God cares about people. And if we care about God, then we're going to have a love for others too. Because that's the only thing that's going to last. Love is. Long after the world is burned up and we enter the fully completed new heavens and new earth, whatever that's going to look like, I don't know. But I know that love will remain. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 8, love never ends. It never corrodes. It never has an expiration date. It never gets stolen. So he has an image here of treasure. He also has an image here of eyes and what eyes do. You see that in 20, 22 and 23. The eye is such an interesting part of our bodies, isn't it? It's such a, in the grand scheme of things, in my 6 foot two, almost 6 foot three frame, my two eyes are just such a small part of me, but in my entire body, this is the only part of me that has the ability to take light inside of me, to go to my brain, to be interpreted so that I can discern the objects around me so that I don't bump into everything, so that I can read, so that I can interact with people. Eyes are just marvelous organs. And so with a good eye, there's a lot of light coming in and so that it can be interpreted. With bad eyes, light cannot enter. We cannot see, and we don't know where we're going. This is such an interesting spiritual application here, because it's not just our bodies that have eyes, our souls have eyes too. You remember in Ephesians where Paul says, he's praying for them, he says that, I want the eyes of your hearts to be enlightened, to be filled with light, God's light, the gospel. That's Ephesians 1:18, if you're taking notes. So what do we have to do for our eyes to be enlightened with God? We have to care about what He cares about and not be blinded by riches. How are we going to follow the gospel with conviction? How are we going to leave the 99 and chase after the one who goes astray? How are we going to do any number of things that Jesus wants us to do, like going and making disciples? As he will talk about at the end of this gospel in chapter 28, how are we going to do anything for Jesus if we are blinded by our interests? If we're just filling up our time to the max with the ease and the pleasures that are so abundantly available to us in our culture. I really appreciate Brent leading the song about Jesus calling us, because that's exactly what he does. He calls us out of our ease and our pleasures and what we want to do with ourselves into what he wants us to be doing. But if I'm really honest with myself, you know, evening comes around or a weekend comes around, or free time comes around whenever it comes around. And what I so often immediately grab for is not something that has to do with the kingdom. It's often just some time-wasting thing that I can fill up the remaining part of my day with that doesn't do anything, either for me or for Jesus' cause. Do you find yourself in that boat too? looking forward to just the time that you can spend vegging on the couch, watching whatever it is that you're watching right now, reading whatever it is that you want to read, doing whatever it is that you want to do, do we have a divided heart or do we have a single-minded focus? Serious questions here. And then in 24, we've got the two different masters idea here. I don't think any of us are used to thinking like slaves, because thankfully slavery in all of its forms is pretty much extinct from our country right now. But if you are a slave, you don't have a 9-to-5 typical American job where you just have the option of walking off the job if you want to. You are completely owned, lock, stock, and barrel by your master. He controls you completely, and so he's not going to let somebody else control you either. Now, sometimes a slave might be loaned to another master, but then he's going to come back home and he's going to serve his true master. So anybody who tries such an arrangement like that is going to go one way or go with the other. We cannot have two allegiances in our hearts at the same time. And there's so many passages that back that up. Do you remember James 4? In verse 4, he says, "You adulterous people." By the way, have you ever thought about your congregation getting the book of James and somebody getting up and reading that and y'all being, everybody just being called adulterous people? How would you take that? "You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." When he says, "Do you not know?" he is saying this is a no-brainer. This is not rocket science. And people in here know about what rocket science means. It's not that. When you get called an adulterous person, that means that you're trying to have another relationship other than the legitimate one that you're in, and the spouse is not going to share you. That's not going to work. And God was very clear about this kind of thing from the beginning in the Old Testament. Do you remember at the very beginning, at the mountain in Exodus 20, what does God say in Exodus 23 and 4? "You shall have no other gods." That was such a weird concept in the ancient world. That was such a weird concept to the Greeks and the Romans. They had tons of gods. And the Roman policy was, we're going to come into your area, but as long as you let our soldiers stay and you pay your taxes like good boys and girls, and you know, you don't rough us up, you can spend your time going to your own temples and praising your gods as long as you worship our emperor too. As long as some Roman gods can set up some idols and some shrines in your area, you can have all the gods that you want. But the true God has always claimed an exclusive relationship. "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth." I love how God just completely lays out all of the categories in case somebody said, "Well, but he didn't mention fish. You know, we can make something out of that looks like a fish, right?" No, nothing. And so just like the Israelites struggled throughout their history with bringing in a Baal or an Asherah or a Molech or some of these other neighboring gods, so it is that we struggle with the temptation to bring in money alongside of our relationship with God. Which master are you serving? And how do you know? How do you know which vision you have, which treasure that you are possessing? Maybe you don't have thousands and thousands sitting in a bank account that you are ready to throw around on somebody else. Maybe things are just really tight for you. Maybe you're thinking about what Jesus is teaching here, and you're thinking, well, compared to a lot of other people, that I know, maybe I don't have a whole lot in the possession department. But Jesus wants to ask you, what are you doing with what you have? Because that goes a long way to answering the question of which treasure do you seek? Like, do you have categories in your budget that are specifically set aside for the cause of helping somebody else? Like, when you see a GoFundMe hitting Facebook or the internet, and it's somebody who's got a mountain of medical bills, and it's somebody in a really hard position, and they're saying, we could really use some help. Have you set aside money in your budget so that when an opportunity like that arises, you can go, yes, I have something that I can give? Or are you so busy spending and saving for yourself that when needs arise around you, you've got nothing to share? There are a lot of people in that camp. Well, I'd like to, but my credit card bill is as long as my arm, and I've got to pay the interest on that. If you get an unexpected tax break, if you get a bump in your monthly salary, what are you going to do with that money? You're going to do something with that money. If you're someone who's received an inheritance of some form or fashion from family members who have passed away, or you anticipate getting an inheritance in the future, what are you going to do with that money? You're going to do something with it. Also, think about the daily interactions that we should be having with each other. As everybody in here is well aware, we don't all live in the same place. We don't all live in Rantoul, even though we come together and we worship here. Some of us are not even in the same county. But are you willing to burn a little bit more gas in your car so that if there is an opportunity away from where you live, maybe there's a singing over there, or there's a study over there, or aside from that, if there's just a person in the group or outside of the group in the community who could really use some encouragement and some help and some one-on-one attention, are you willing to burn a little bit more gas in order to make that happen? Yeah, it costs money to do that, and especially with the war now and gas prices getting hiked, it's going to cost more money to do that. But isn't that why God gives us money to begin with? To not be used as just a tool for ourselves, but for other people. I know I'm jumping to a lot of different kinds of applications. I'm going to jump to another one here. The shepherds have recently told us some very interesting things about the church budget. By the way, I want to say this really clearly. They don't even know that I'm about to say this. So please don't think that any of what I am going to say is at all coming from them. They've not encouraged me to say anything about this. But they've said some interesting things about our church budget and how it's being kept afloat. And so I want to ask this question for all of us to think about. Whatever resources that you have, are you generously sharing with the work that we are trying to do together financially? Because there's a lot of things that we could do. When we run out of Bibles, and I hope to be able to run out of Bibles soon, I'd like to buy some more. Would love to do some targeted online advertising in this area for evangelistic purposes. It costs money to do that, though. As a much larger expense, I would really love to see more classrooms in this building. Because we're blessed with a lot of kids here. A lot of kids. And I'll also say this, it would be really, really neat if we had another option for a smaller adult class instead of just the one big one inside of this room. That costs money to do that. In that last case, it costs a lot of money to do that. But there are a lot of things that we could do if we had vision, if we had faith, if we had generosity. So I don't think that Jesus is saying here in Matthew that you need to empty your entire savings account and you need to throw it into the collection plate next week, right? But isn't he saying that we should be quick to thoughtfully use whatever money that we have in the service of other people, because loving neighbor as myself is the greater context of this part of Jesus' sermon. So connected to that idea, we start 25 through 34 now. This might seem like two sermons squashed together into one, but I want you to notice in 25, Jesus himself makes a connection here, because you see what he says, therefore. And whenever you see therefore, it's meant to link up with whatever's come right before it. Therefore, I tell you, do not be anxious. So real quickly, I want to blow through eight arguments that Jesus makes that are not terribly complicated. You probably read them before, but they're so powerful every time that we do get exposed to them. In 25, he's going to make the point that life is so much greater than what sustains it physically. So the previous section is about making a choice between serving God and serving money, and that's still under discussion here. And so he's going to ask us to think about, is our life just about the clothing that we wear or the food that we eat or the basic necessities that we use and pile up? No, it's not. Just like when you drive your car, is it just about going to the gas station? I mean, your car needs to go to the gas station. Otherwise, you're going to run it for some miles, and then you can't run it anymore. But going to the gas station is just a means to an end. You go there, you fill up your tank so that you can get back out on the road, which is what you want to do, because you got places to go and people to see. In the same way, we all need food. We all need clothing. We all need some things in our lives, and Jesus is pointing that out here. But they also are just a means to an end. They are in our lives so that we can be equipped and be strong in our bodies and minds to be able then to do the things that he wants us to do. It's why we're on earth. In 26, I love the practicality of this, where Jesus just says, so look at those things flying around in the air. How do they survive? And again, this sermon is preached on a hill in Galilee. I can imagine that there are birds flying around Jesus and the crowd as he's saying these words. So he may have like looked up at a flock and just said, look at those things right over there. How do they live? They don't have a process for making food and storing up food. They don't have the capability to sow and reap and put their harvest in a barn. Every day they wake up and they don't have a pantry and they don't have a chest freezer. And yet they seem to not be worried about that. Right now, this is grackle season at the Combs house. I don't know if you got a lot of grackles in your yard in the spring, but you know those black birds with the blue heads, different from the starlings because grackles don't have spots. You know, they seem to really like our arborvitaes. And so every spring, they come to our yard in droves and they make their nests and they do their bird calls that sound really scratchy. And they're not my favorite bird. They hop around my yard and they eat what they can find. Usually a lot of it's my bird seed. God feeds them that. He created them. He makes sure that they have what they need. So, argument from the lesser to the greater. If he cares about birds, if he feeds birds, how much more, how much in a greater way is he going to care for your needs? Jesus did not come to die for birds. He came to die for us. We are his sons and his daughters. We are made in his image. If he feeds them abundantly, he's going to take care of us. In 27, Jesus pivots to something else that I think is really helpful. That anxiety doesn't do you a lick of good, objectively. It is completely pointless because it doesn't actually change anything. So there's no purpose in worrying. Now, verse 27 is going to look different depending on your translation. So if you're using New King James or you're using King James, it's going to say, which of you by worrying can add one cubit to his stature? If you're using the ESV or something like it that I'm using, it's which of you by being anxious can add a single hour to his span of life? But regardless of whether this is a little bit more time or a little bit more height, the point is still the same, that you can't change who you are or what you're experiencing in any significant, meaningful way. And if anything, worrying, being anxious, it actually takes away hours of your life. As your hair falls out and you know you get super stressed, it's not good physically for you. But we got to realize that what other people think, what other people do around us is outside of our control. What the American economy does, to a large extent, is outside of our hands. We have the ability to go to the ballot box and vote for the leaders that we want to see in the White House or the Congress, but you're one vote and I'm one vote out of millions. So we don't practically have a lot of sway over that either. What happens to our job security is often out of our hands. We can try to do good, and we can try to perform, and we can try to be excellent employees, but ultimately, there are budget cuts. And ultimately, there are bigger issues at hand sometimes. So it doesn't make sense, Jesus says, to crush our minds with futile thoughts that are outside of our hands. And then he goes back to nature. And I don't entirely understand why he pivots the way he does, but he's been looking at birds, and now he says some things about anxiety, and then he goes back to nature, and he says, look over at those beautiful flowers over there. They don't toil, and they don't spin. Jesus isn't saying that the lilies of the field are lazy bums. He's saying that their beautiful color and their appearance is because of a God outside of them that is doing that for them. He clothes them, and they are exquisite. They are gorgeous. And we're at the time of the year where we're about to experience the flower explosion that happens every spring. Even Solomon, Jesus says, in all of his glory. And I don't know what that looked like exactly, but you can read Kings, and you can read about the gold, and you can read about the servants, and you can read about the house that he lived in. He must have looked like something else. And Jesus says, yeah, those flowers, Solomon can't touch them. God chose to give that to a plant. And those plants don't last very long, he says. They're here today, but tomorrow they're going to be thrown into the fire. The bloom's going to be gone, and we're about to see that happen in real time. And so again, this is an argument from the lesser to the greater. If he does that for plants, how much more is he going to help you because of your status with him? In verse 31, we have another simple but really effective, powerful argument from Jesus about anxiety living in this world. He says, this way, the way of anxiety, is the way that everybody else thinks out there. But you are not everybody else. Now keep in mind, who is Jesus talking to? He's talking to Jews. God's chosen people, but he's also talking to his people, his disciples, because you go back to the first part of chapter 5, that is the audience who is listening to him. So people on the outside, they have good reason to stress about their lives because according to their viewpoint, it's all on their shoulders to figure out going through this life. Because without the comforting presence of God saying things like this, then yeah, you would have a lot of stress. Now, back in 5:45, you remember how Jesus says, right before chapter 6, that he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good. He sends rain to everybody. But the unjust person doesn't know that. They don't know that, that he cares and that he gives and that he's generous and kind. They don't have assurances of God's care. Jesus says, you're not a Gentile. You have a Father, verse 32, who cares about you. And as we read this passage together, for the most part, this room is filled with disciples. This room is filled with people who have already committed themselves to Jesus Christ. Maybe you've got a lot going on right now in your life. Job-wise, health-wise, relationship-wise, this ought to be a comfort to you. Because God doesn't just see you and see, here's a person that I've made. He looks at you and says, here is a son, here is a daughter who's committed himself or herself to my son. That means a lot to him, and that's an understatement. Verse 32, God is not an alien in outer space who is oblivious to the things that are going on in our little lives. He is, verse 32, keenly aware of what we need. He created the body to need food, to need drink. He gave the clothes, the first clothes that were made. After Adam and Eve had tried to sew some leaves together to make loincloths for themselves, and that clearly wasn't working very well, it was God who was the one who killed some animals and gave the skins to Adam and Eve so that they would have proper clothing to wear on their bodies. God is the one who has made us, who takes care of us, so of course he knows about our needs. And again, he is a father, he says to us. What do fathers do? Good fathers, fathers who are patterning their role after the ideal of God the Father, good fathers are aware of what is going on in their children's lives. 1 Timothy 5, a good father has compassion for the physical needs of his family. And building on that idea in 33, I love the promise that is made here in this text. Notice what Jesus says. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these physical things, will be added to you. So he's not just aware, he's also responsive. The added to you is implied that he's the one who's going to be doing the adding, not us. And this it really fits with passages like Psalm 37 in verse 25, where the writer says, I have been young, and now I am old, and yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken or his children begging for bread. If you're doing the work that God wants you to be involved in, he's going to make sure that you have the vital necessities that you need to do your work. Now, this is not a promise for a lot of wealth. This is not a promise for perfect health. This is not a social prosperity gospel. This is the true gospel here. And sometimes suffering in really big ways is how you carry forward the work of the kingdom. Sometimes that's going to mean without going It's going to mean going without comfort in some ways, but this is a promise that for as long as we're here, as long as we're doing kingdom work, God's going to be giving us supplies that we need to do that work. And then finally, in verse 34, I love how Jesus simply says, "You've got today. Don't be stressing about what happens tomorrow." And for us who have the ability to create calendars that go years and years in advance, this is something that is really helpful for us to hear. If we're going to be productive, anxiety-free servants, we need to think carefully about time. Both time in the future, but also time in the past. You and I have no control over what has happened to us before this present moment. All of the embarrassing things that you and I have done, or things that have been done to us. The good that we have done, the bad that we have done or said, all of it is locked into place in history and we can't touch it. And going forward, it's humbling to know that we have no control over the future. We don't even have the next day, let alone the next minute, that we know what's going to happen or it's guaranteed to us. We live in the now. And so don't allow the stress of what has or what is going to happen affect what God can use you for at the moment. He gives the strength that we need for the future battles when they come. But focus on fighting the one that's right in front of you. The message here is simple. It's not that profound. But it is so powerful and so challenging and so helpful, because I dare say that all of us, to one extent or another, deal with this. We have a choice about the master that we serve. Are we going to try our best to live our lives trying to get things for ourselves? Or are we going to cast away the idols of this culture that is all about anxious accumulation and fully devote ourselves to kingdom work? I'm strongly reminded of the end of Joshua when I think about this part of Jesus' sermon. Do you remember in Joshua 24, Joshua famously says, "As for me and my house, this is what we're going to do. We're going to serve the Lord." But in that whole conversation in Joshua 24, he's laying the choice out for the Israelites. He's asking them, "What are you guys going to do?" And they say, "We're going to do that too. We're going to serve the Lord." And you remember how Joshua says in that chapter, "No, you are not going to do that. You can't make that choice." And they say, "What are you talking about? We are going to do that. We are going to serve God." And then Joshua lowers the boom and he says, "Well, if you are going to do, if you're serious about that, you have to get all the idols out of your tents that you've been carrying around with you this entire time." Joshua's point is, you can't serve God if you are also serving those little idols under your pillow. And Jesus' point is the same. You cannot serve God and mammon, or money, as is translated in my translation. We have a choice to make between them. Which one will we choose? Appreciate your attention to the words of God. We can help you at all this morning with your spiritual life, to be an encouragement and a help to you. If you know that you have a different master in mind that you want to choose, and you're tired of serving a master who has been a relentless and vicious slave driver in your life, please leave that master. You don't have to follow him anymore. Because the king is here, and he wants to rule over your life if you give it to him. So please do that. Together as we stand up and we sing the invitation song, Brent Selected.